True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
It's unfathomable that a nurse, a person who is trained to be caring and compassionate and healing, could actually be killing. And the question is why? Male serial killers are usually power mongers, but female serial killers usually have very different motives. It's need for attention, playing the hero so that she can save the day. Kristen was a pretty normal kid. She always had a lot of friends and was popular in her peers. Because of this, she got a lot of attention growing up, and she became addicted to getting attention. She became a chronic and manipulative liar. No matter how much attention she got, she always needed more. And no one knows exactly why, but the narcissism probably developed to the level of borderline personality disorder. She was considered a great nurse and loved by her colleagues. But in 1995, the number of suspicious deaths spiked at the local veterans hospital. This should not have happened. And her fellow nurses are beginning to realize this isn't just a case of chronic bad luck. They're beginning to wonder, is this murder? Kristen is a classic female serial killer because she has what we call an intrinsic locus of attention. It's all about me, me. She is the number one priority in her own life. She's self-absorbed. And if people have to die in the process of her getting what she wants, it's just an unfortunate side effect.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Apparently hardworking and intelligent, mother of two, and registered nurse, Kristen Gilbert was living the life of a middle-class soccer mom. She had a good job, a loving husband, and two children. She seemed a lot like the other Massachusetts suburbanites in her neighborhood. But she held sinister secrets that would eventually bubble to the surface. Beneath the facade of an ordinary working mother, Kristen lived a life of duplicity. Before her 30th birthday, she was arrested on suspicion of serial murder, injecting patients at the hospital where she worked with lethal doses of epinephrine. These were vulnerable victims, and Kristen's motives were a mystery, perhaps even to herself. It may have been as simple as a need for attention and excitement. When a healthcare professional takes a life, it's a special kind of evil. Trained and relied upon to protect and restore health, and virtually holding their patients' lives in their hands, a nurse who kills betrays the most basic trust while preying on the sick. Join us at the quiet end today for Murder by Nurse, the victims of Kristen Gilbert.
And we have a Massachusetts beer. This takes place in Western Mass. And the beer I have is not quite as far as Western Mass, but kind of midway. It's from Treehouse Brewing. It's called Triple Shot, and it's an Imperial Stout. You know how much I love stouts.
I know. Stout.
I haven't done a stout for a while. This one is a black beer. Nice thick tan head. Retains pretty well, so you can see a nice streak of lace down the side of the glass.
Okay.
It's got a very beautiful coffee and chocolate aroma.
Well, I do love that. I love the smell of a stout. It's the drinking that, have to be in a certain mood.
Well, this will put you in the mood. Maybe.
You hope so.
It's got a sweet chocolate taste, followed by some espresso. Really nice. A full-bodied, kind of oily, viscous beer. So it kind of lingers in your mouth. It's a very nice, long-lasting taste of espresso.
So it should get us through the whole episode.
It should.
Awesome. Yeah,
we'll sip it. It's 9% alcohol by volume, so it's not one we're going to chug down. We'll sip slowly and share.
Yeah, I don't think we've chugged anything recently. I think our chugging days are in the past.
Oh, yeah, they definitely are.
Okay. All right, Dickie, why don't you start this story? I think it's pretty horrific, but I really think you're going to have a lot of input for me on it.
So you think. We'll see.
Okay.
In November 1967, the Red Cross sent U.S. Coast Guard serviceman Richard Strickland a telegram informing him he was a new father. Kristen Heather Strickland was a healthy, chubby baby with a head of dark hair. So 6 months after Kristen was born, Richard learned that he was going home to Fall River. Now, this is a small mill town on the southern coast of Massachusetts. And actually, he and his wife, Claudia, had both grown up there. So in May 1968, Claudia and baby Kristen, along with Richard's father and mother, picked him up at Boston's Logan Airport. And this was the first time Richard had met his daughter face to face. Now, when she was 3, the Stricklands enrolled her in a Christian preschool. Claudia was working as a substitute teacher, and Richard was working on a career as an electrical engineer. Kristen was an only child for about 7 years, but then her sister Tara was born in 1974.
So that was a life change for her as a child. You're the only child for a while and a baby comes in?
For a good while, 7 years.
Yeah. So that kind of changed things for her. And she began spending more time with her grandmother, Isabella Morgan, who lived just down the street, so that was convenient. Isabel and her husband, Claude, veteran of the Fall River Police Department, owned a small beach house in Rhode Island. Claude didn't like the beach, but he bought the place for the kids to enjoy. And because Tara was still so little, Isabel would take Kristen to the beach every weekend. And the beach soon became little Kristen's favorite place.
Sure, plus, look at that. She's with Grandma, maybe Grandpa, all that attention.
I think she got a lot of attention.
Sure.
And did you notice that the grandfather's name is Claude, and then her mom's name was Claudia? We see the connection there.
See? Claude Jr.
That's right.
As Kristen Strickland made her way through elementary school and then junior high, she began to brag that she was related to Lizzie Borden. Now, Lizzie's probably one of the most famous residents of Fall River. Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her father 40 whacks, or was it a mother? Anyway.
Well, she killed both of them. That's all I know.
Yeah.
And it is kind of legendary.
Yeah, but she's nowhere near a relative of Lizzie Borden.
No, but this was one in a series of lies that were piling up on her list from a young age. Kristen was a cute kid. She loved the beach, and she used to sew quilts with her grandmother, get lots of attention. But she was on her way at a very young age to becoming a pathological liar. Or as they said back then, she made up stories. But as she got older, it wasn't so cute.
And she lied about everything.
A lot of things, yeah.
So in the early 80s, the Stricklands moved to Groton, Massachusetts. This is a New England town of about 9,000, just south of the New Hampshire border. They lived in a modest home on a busy main road. Although the family once took a trip to Disney World and often took the kids on weekend trips to New Hampshire and Vermont, it apparently was not a very joyful home life. Her parents were strict, and they ran a very disciplined house. But when she got to be 15, Kristen rebelled against the parents and would spend a lot of time out of the house. And as we said, she lied. So she is continuing to lie and make up stories about herself.
Yeah, and because of that, I would guess she rarely had good relationships with her female peers. And then her relationships with boys were just really drama-filled, as you can imagine. I mean, it usually is kind of that way anyway in the teens, but with someone like her, the drama was multiplied.
Certainly was.
She even tried to convince some of her friends once that her mother was a horrible alcoholic who beat her up. But not only did family and friends deny that that was true, they believed that Kristen had exaggerated feelings of anger for her mother. Maybe just for having another child.
Sure.
But being popular, thin, and attractive with curly long brown hair, Kristen had no trouble getting dates in high school. Her yearbook picture shows a smiling, confident-looking teenager. She had friends, and she seemed to enjoy many extracurricular activities. So in many ways, she was like any other student until you got to know her. And as she became known for frequent lying, she was also very smart. She worked her way through sophomore and junior years of high school, and it became obvious that she was above average. She was in the top 10% of her class and became a gifted cornet player. She joined the marching band, orchestra, and jazz ensemble. She became a member of the math team, and she whizzed through her classes with very little studying.
Yeah, in fact, she graduated like 2.5, 3 years.
Early?
From high school, yeah. She was through her sophomore, junior year.
She was 16, I believe.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's pretty impressive.
So, it sure is.
But also, we know now that it's not always great for kids to go ahead like that for their psychosocial stability and growth.
We know that, don't we?
We know that now, at least. Yeah.
So as Kristen got older, a more vengeful, mean side of her came to the surface. Pamela Erickson was a neighbor who became good friends with Kristen. They rode the same bus and they would hang out after school. But Pamela's mom wasn't happy about her daughter hanging out with the Strickland girl, as she referred to Kristen.
Well, that Strickland girl, I don't want her around my house.
That's right. So Kristen had mentioned to her friend, Pamela, that she was infatuated by an evil nurse character, Amy Vining, who was on General Hospital. This was a soap opera that the two girls used to watch together after school. Amy was a conniving, backstabbing character hated by most fans of the show, and that's Kristen's favorite.
You know, I didn't watch General Hospital. I watched The Guiding Light because that's what my girlfriend's stay-at-home mom watched, and we watch it with her. But I know that General Hospital was super popular.
Sure.
But it was kind of disturbing to her friend, like, well, why do you like the evil character the most? And I don't know if it was just that Kristen liked to be different or if she really admired that kind of personality. We don't know. But it's possible, isn't it?
It sure is.
There was another time when Pamela couldn't find one of her favorite shirts, and then Kristen showed up at her house wearing it. Kristen insisted that the shirt was hers, even though both girls knew that she was lying. Now, these are little things, but bigger things were to come, and I see these as signs of trouble.
Well, they are, no question. So, like I said, she did graduate about 1.5 years before the rest of her class. In 1984, graduated with high honors, and she was accepted at Bridgewater State College, and she enrolled there as a pre-med student at age 16.
That's impressive.
It is.
And life seemed to be going pretty well for young Kristen. She was in college, also living close to New Hampshire, which she liked because she liked to spend free time at Hampton Beach. That's a resort town with a lot of young people, lots of things to do on the weekends. At least during the summer months. I think it's kind of dead in the winter. But we've been to Hampton Beach. We know that area.
Yeah.
Very touristy.
Oh, it's a horrible place.
It's not a horrible place. Come on.
Pretty bad.
Well, I mean, by bad, what do you mean? You mean the crowds and the...
It's crowded. It's cheesy, honky-tonk.
Right. But I mean, for young people, that's fun.
Yeah, it is. For old crabby people, it's not so much.
No, old crabby people think it's a horrible place.
See?
Yeah. Kristen dated several guys throughout college. She was never the one to end a relationship, but she did feel like she had to have the final say. She couldn't let go after a breakup without getting some revenge. And she gained a reputation as mentally unstable, as well as a skilled manipulator. Whenever she felt she'd lost control of a relationship or a situation, first she would beg for forgiveness, claiming she would do anything to save the relationship. But if that failed, she'd become malicious, even becoming violent and definitely becoming verbally abusive.
Yeah, there was one boy she was dating in high school, and he broke up with her, and she left him a suicide note saying that she's going to eat glass. So, of course, the boy hurried over to her house. But Kristen's fine. However, then she began to make harassing phone calls to his house. And he confronted her about this, about making the calls. She got very pissed off at him and gouged her fingernails into his cheek, making him bleed. Fairly deep scratches.
So violent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there's another boyfriend from around the same time said he had gotten the same sort of treatment when he didn't want to date her anymore. This time, Kristen tore the spark plug wires out of his car, keyed the paint, and slit the tires.
Well, it's better than cutting the brake lines, I guess.
Well, okay.
That's very vengeful.
Sure is.
And she had a temper that she really apparently didn't know how to control.
She had a very quick temper.
And the other thing, I mean, more basic, is that she just didn't know how to deal with her emotions in any way. And I don't know how much of that is nature or nurture.
Well, we can debate that for a long time, can't we?
Sure. But what do you think about that?
Well, I'm going to straddle the middle.
Okay, that's easy. Well, I'm thinking that's a little more nurture to me, that you need to teach kids how to deal with their feelings a little bit. So, of course, you've always got nature involved, but I think that there's a little bit something there in her upbringing where she was kind of spoiled, the center of attention, and didn't really know how to deal with disappointment or loss.
Well, sure, but there has to be something there to begin with.
Absolutely, I agree. Now, when she was in college, like I said, that didn't much change from her behavior in high school. During the summer of 1986, after a year in college and several tumultuous relationships, Kristen met a plain-looking guy from Northampton, Massachusetts, who was on vacation in Hampton Beach for the week, and this was Glenn Gilbert. He was tall and lanky, attractive in a boyish sort of way. 2 years older than her, Glenn fell for the 17-year-old Kristen. She was very outspoken, and now she was a blonde. She had decided to study nursing, and she was an excellent student, but by the end of June 1987, she transferred to Greenfield Community College, which is just a 20-minute drive from Northampton, to continue studying nursing and to be closer to Glenn. So it seems like she was putting her relationship above her education a little bit. Not that there's anything wrong with community college, but I think it was kind of a step down from where she was.
Well, she was in a 4-year school.
Right, so she went to a 2-year.
I mean, if she decided she wanted to be a nurse, she can get that education at a community college, too.
Yes.
So while she was attending classes at the community college, Kristen took a job as a home health aide with the Visiting Nurses Association. And one of her first patients was a blind, deaf, mute, severely handicapped little boy who lived with a foster family. The family also had a younger foster child, had already had Kristen's co-worker, who was a woman in her late 20s, over to the house on several occasions to care for the two children. So when Kristen and her co-worker arrived one summer evening in 1987, the co-worker introduced Kristen to the family and showed her where to bathe the boy. So the foster parents leave the house and the older health nurse went to care for the younger boy. And an hour or so later, when the parents returned, and Kristen and the co-workers left the home, when the foster mother checked on the boy who Kristen had cared for, she saw that his legs were bright red where the level of the bathwater had been. So he had been scalded over about 60% of his body. And this is going to be something impossible to have done by mistake, because the family had ordered a special faucet that was preset to a safe temperature. So the only way to raise the temperature was to unlock the faucet and adjust it.
So why would she do that?
That's pretty damning evidence, isn't it?
Yeah, but let's talk about why. Why would she want to hurt a handicapped child like that?
Well, there's fundamentally something wrong with her, isn't there?
Yes. Pent-up anger?
Who knows? I mean, she was always flying off the handle about something.
I know, but this is like the most vulnerable person you could pretty much think of.
Yeah.
But also, this was someone she knew she could get away with it.
Yeah, I mean, the kid's not going to say anything.
He couldn't. No, he couldn't speak.
So the foster mother called the VNA the next morning and said they had never had a problem with the faucet before. And she checked it out herself afterwards and it worked fine. So she told the VNA that she refused to let Kristen Gilbert come back to their house to care for her child, which they agreed to do. But there's no discipline for Kristen. She's not fired. She's still an aide for the VNA.
Yeah, well, it was kind of, you know, her word against theirs.
It was. And they were less likely to fire people back then. Discipline, reprimand, relocate them, do other things, but they wouldn't fire them.
Well, by Christmas time of 87, Glenn and Kristen decided to get married. And they wanted to elope because they didn't have the money for a big wedding. So by February of 88, Kristen Strickland became Kristen Gilbert. A month after the wedding, Kristen almost killed her new husband. During an argument, she pulled an 8-inch butcher knife out of a kitchen drawer and she went after Glenn, chasing him from room to room in a rage. Afraid, Glenn locked himself inside a room and waited until she calmed down. He hoped that this was just an isolated incident related to the stress that she was going through from eloping and working and going to school. But eventually, Glenn would realize that he was in a marriage that was really based on deceit, adultery, threats, and even attempts on his life. But he loved her, so what are you going to do? You're going to say, oh, it'll get better. You're going to make excuses.
He did. For quite some time.
He did. And he was kind of a passive, nice guy. He was the type of guy that she could manipulate. That's what she was attracted to.
Yes, she certainly was. So Kristen graduated from Greenfield Community College when she was 21. So it took her a little more time to get through that, didn't it?
It did.
And soon after, she began her nursing career at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center, VAMC, in 1989. And it didn't take long before Kristen was seen as the nurse who had the worst luck when it came to her patients. One after another, her patients began to code and, in many cases, die.
So code can be stopping breathing, heart stopping. It's an emergency.
It's an emergency.
It's a life-threatening emergency.
And you need to act quickly to get the person back in normal shape.
Yeah. But I think one thing to really think about with the code is the reaction it causes, right? Because when you call a code, everybody comes running. So there's nothing that's going to get you more attention running a code.
That's right.
Yeah. Lewis Traynor was one of Kristen's unfortunate patients, we think. She was never convicted for that death. Like many of the patients who came to the VAMC for long-term treatment, Traynor had some emotional problems. Despite the psychological wounds that he'd been through at age 51, he was still in good physical health. Early in 1990, he was admitted to the VAMC because he was having problems with his esophagus. Many years prior, he had swallowed Drano in a suicide attempt.
That is just a horrible way to try to kill yourself.
I can't think of much more painful and miserable than that. Awful. That's so sad. So, because of that, he wasn't able to eat by himself because those chemicals had burned him so severely. But instead of having reconstructive surgery, which I imagine would have been many surgeries, he decided to have a feeding tube put in his stomach. Now, as sad as that is, his condition was not life-threatening and he was getting along okay. He'd come to the hospital for preventative IV antibiotic treatments. And Kristen Gilbert and two RNs were working on the floor the night that he was admitted. So he was also schizophrenic, and shortly after being sent up to Ward C, where Kristen was working, he began screaming, "Oh God, just let me die, God, please let me die." Which sounds shocking if you've never known or worked with anyone with a severe mental illness, but this was actually kind of routine behavior for Traynor. He was delusional, and he suffered from manic depression as well. The nurses knew it was normal for him to scream, so they weren't terribly alarmed by this. As he intermittently screamed for about an hour, each of the nurses would take turns, periodically going in to check on him and making sure he was okay. But each time the nurse went in, he would say, "I don't want to live anymore. Won't someone let me die?" On this particular night, he became more agitated than usual, and his behavior was really disrupting the nurses as they worked. Patients were even complaining about it to the nurses. But Traynor would not stop yelling, so the nurses just tried to ignore it. But at one point, one of the nurses was caring for another patient, and she stopped what she was doing because she realized she hadn't heard from him for a while. And when she went to check in on him, he was dead. There'd been no code called. He was just lying there dead, just like that.
Yeah, so he passed away unattended by anybody.
Well, that's the belief. We don't know where Kristen was.
Or unattended by anyone except his killer.
Yeah, and one of the nurses later checked to see who his primary care nurse was that shift, and it was Kristen. It was concerning because there really wasn't any recognizable medical reason for him to have died.
Yeah, not that kind of sudden death.
No. And years later, most people would believe that he was an early victim of Kristen Gilbert.
Yeah, and later that same year, a VAMC staff physician was reviewing charts of his patients who had died during the night shift hours when Kristen worked. And he noted that Kristen's name kept showing up repeatedly for the majority of the deaths. So this didn't necessarily mean that she was killing anybody, but she was almost always alone with the patients at the time of their deaths. And more suspicious was the fact that most, if not all of them, were not expected to die.
Right, exactly. These were unexpected deaths of people who had issues, but not life-threatening conditions.
Right. So one morning after he found out that another one of his patients had died while under Kristen's care, the doctor went to talk to the nurse manager, and he told her that he didn't want Kristen Gilbert taking care of any more of his patients. So I guess that was done, but no disciplinary action was taken against her. At the same time, Kristen's colleagues, her nursing colleagues, had heard about what the doctor had said, and they began to shun the doctor in her defense. So they're sticking up for their girl, Kristen.
Well, yeah, early on she was very popular and very well regarded because she was pretty sharp.
She was one of the brighter people and had a good grasp of nursing.
Right, exactly. She did become known as the Angel of Death, but that was a joke. No one meant it as a serious indictment against her. Other nurses would tease her about her terrible luck, but she seemed to enjoy that. She liked the attention. But by late 1991, a clerk at the VAMC who was assigned with going through patient death records, just to ensure their accuracy and that they were complete, noticed that Kristen was the only nurse who had found a majority of the patients who had either been in cardiac arrest or had died on the Ward C. On Gilbert's shift alone, between 90 and 91, there were 31 deaths. That's more than triple the number on any other shift. Of those 31 deaths, Kristen had found 22 of them herself.
So that means that she was the one who called the code.
Yes.
She walked in and there's a patient in distress.
According to her.
Yep.
The next closest nurse had found only 5. So there's a big discrepancy there if you're thinking about likelihood of these being real. And by real, I mean accidental or medically related incidents.
Right.
So this meant that Kristen Gilbert was working and had found about 75% of the total deaths on her ward. These numbers are overwhelming.
They are. I mean, it's just an incredible statistical bit of information.
Well, it's more than an anomaly. It's just crazy.
Yeah, but we'll see what happens with that info.
I know, but it takes so long, right? Just
right.
Like with the doctors we've talked about.
Yep.
Anyone in this kind of position, it just takes so long for anything to happen. And then upon further examination, the numbers of codes were even more shocking. Out of 40 codes called on Ward C between 90 and 91, Kristen had found half of them, 20 of them.
Yeah, and then in 1990, she called 13 codes, while her 8 colleagues had found a total of 5. So that's just another amazing statistic. Many of the nurses said throughout their entire nursing careers, sometimes as long as 20 or 30 years, they had not once called the code. So there's later a statistician concluded that the possibility of it being coincidence that Kristen Gilbert had found and called that many codes was 1 in 1,000,000.
Yeah, there's no way that one nurse could have so much bad luck. And why doesn't she recognize this in her mind? That's something I'd like to ask a psychiatrist. She's delusional. If she thinks that this is happening and people are just going to believe her, that's a delusion. And it reminds me of the delusions like, for example, Ted Bundy had, that he felt like he was just going to get away with everything. Kind of like you're invisible and you're just going around doing your thing and there's no way anyone will ever be on to you.
Right. You're a ghost.
Okay. But that's a weird phenomena.
So the clerk who made these observations went to her supervisor, and the supervisor says to her, "So what are you going to do? What are you accusing this nurse of?" And then she says, "Nothing. I'm just pointing out that this nurse's name is on a majority of these deaths and codes. I'm not saying she did anything." So the supervisor told her to go back to doing her job and to stop making false accusations against nurses.
That's a lot of help.
I know. I mean, again, you don't want to think that one of your nurses is intentionally harming patients.
I understand that.
At the same time, how can you ignore these numbers?
Because they're facts, right? And facts should come before your opinions on a person.
Yeah. And even if you don't think that your girl could be causing harm to patients, that certainly looks like it should be further investigated. I mean, those are just absolutely overwhelming numbers.
Exactly, yeah. So that clerk was just ignored.
Right.
In December of 1990, Kristen went out on maternity leave to have her first child. After having a baby boy that she named Brian, she returned to work in February of 91. At this point, she started working the second shift, which was 4 p.m. to midnight. And despite being known as the Angel of Death, she did seem to have been transformed by her motherhood. Now she was seen as a nurse and a housewife, leading a mundane life similar to the rest of them. She'd gotten heavier, and her dirty blonde hair was cut and held back with pastel-colored bows. She liked to be thought of as the perfect mother. She seemed happy, too, at this time of her life, and she really seemed to love her job. As time went on, Kristen and her co-workers began having family cookouts and going to each other's houses for dinner parties. Her husband, Glenn, bought a boat, and they took it out on the Connecticut River. Kristen organized baby showers for her pregnant colleagues. Their activities were mostly family-oriented, but the nurses did go out to area clubs on their nights off. Kristen rarely talked about her childhood or her teen years. She was not known as antisocial and narcissistic. No one knew she'd threatened violence against several boyfriends and that she'd even tried to stab her husband. To her colleagues and friends, she was a caring nurse and mom. But then, some not-so-subtle signs emerged that revealed that things were not so perfect with Kristen. One day, after answering the phone at the nurse's station, Kristen came running down the hallway screaming, "I just got a call from a guy who said he planted a bomb on the ward."
Yeah. So Renee Walsh is one of the nurses working that night with Kristen. And this just didn't make any sense at all to her. Who would go through the trouble of putting a bomb on the second floor of a VA hospital? "Okay, Kristen, calm down," Renee said. And then she called the police. David Rezhniak was the charge nurse that night, and he was responsible if anything went wrong. So police get to the ward, and they did an extensive search, finding nothing. After the police left and things had settled down, Renee Walsh was sitting at the nurse's station when she heard Kristen, down the hall and around the corner, near the janitor's closet, say in a loud, whispering voice, "David, David, oh David," as if she were playing. "I think you ought to come down here. There's something in the closet I think you need to see." So Renee got up and walked toward Kristen's voice, and David Rezhniak was walking back up the hallway after speaking with Kristen. He told Renee that Kristen said she found a suspicious-looking box in the closet with a swastika on it.
Yeah, so very weird. Renee went down to see for herself. And it was a Kleenex box wrapped in white paper with a swastika drawn crudely in pen on the side of it. The charge nurse, David, had to call the police back and ask them to return. And then it took hours for the Massachusetts State Police bomb squad to arrive. While they were on their way, the ward had to be evacuated, and every patient was transported to another ward. The bomb squad was very quickly able to determine that it was just a box of Kleenex wrapped in white paper. And then the patients were brought back to their rooms.
That's a pretty crude bomb, isn't it?
Yeah. And the rest of the shift passed uneventfully. This was Valentine's Day, so the nurses later jokingly referred to that night as being their own little version of the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Some of the nurses later speculated that it was Kristen who had planted that box. But why? Maybe so she could get attention for being the one who took the call and found the box? It was very strange.
Well, but that's exactly why she did that, for the attention.
But was it for the excitement, too? Was she bored?
Well, possibly. Again, we're going to talk, I guess, down the road about her narcissistic personality disorder. It all centers around her.
Right.
So she'll take the attention anywhere she can get it.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. But still, to many of her colleagues, she was still the perfect mom, the perfect wife, and the perfect nurse. She seemed like a caring person. She spent time volunteering at local homeless shelters. At least that's what she told them. And she had a room in her home dedicated to sewing, where she would make Christmas stockings and quilts and give them away to coworkers for their children. But Kristen really wasn't genuinely caring and kind. Like you said, it was all about the attention. At the VAMC, she told people that her mother's real name was Tisha, a name given to her by a royal family. She also told people she had spent time living and studying in England. She often said that her parents were wealthy socialites and connected to English royalty. Now, all of these were lies, of course. And she always had to be the best at everything and have the best of everything. For a while, she became obsessed with clothing and home items. She had to have the most expensive toys and clothing for her kids. Her home was decorated in expensive brands, too. When someone would come over, she showed off whatever new linens, curtains, or furniture she had bought. But her buying habits were kind of fraudulent because she was living beyond her means. She ordered expensive clothing, wore it for a certain event, and then returned it after the event was over. She really seemed to have this need to one-up everyone, as if she was threatened in some way.
Yeah, and it wasn't just clothing that she'd return. I mean, there was furnishings and stuff. She would order top-of-the-line things, keep them for a short time, and return them.
Yes, exactly. Which I think a lot of people have done that once or twice. I might have done it once when I was young. But to do it all the time like that is very psychotic and dishonest, of course. Doing it at all is dishonest.
You'd think the store clerks would get a little suspicious.
I think after a while they might.
So Rachel Weber was an attractive young nurse who had worked with Kristen during the early 90s, and they became good friends. So one night in 93, Rachel told Kristen that she was thinking of buying a new Jeep Grand Cherokee, but she wasn't sure her husband would agree, so she put it off as a long-term goal. Now, just weeks later, Kristen came into work and began talking about the new Jeep she had bought. Rachel later said, well, she was always like that. If she knew you wanted something, she usually went out and bought it for herself.
And that's a big deal.
Again, like you're talking about, one-upping.
That's a really big deal because these aren't people who can afford to just go out and buy a Jeep.
Nope.
You know, she's a working woman. Her husband's a working guy. But why was it so important to her just to get the car that her friend wanted?
Well, because her friend really wanted it.
I know, right?
So it was important for her to get it first.
I guess so. I mean, I would think if your friend really wants it, you'd want to buy it for her or help her get it.
Well, friendship only goes so far.
Yeah, I guess. In November of 93, Kristen and Glenn's second son, Raymond, was born on Kristen's birthday. And for most of the early 90s, things seemed to be going along well for their family. They did argue about the usual domestic issues, but nothing that would make you think their marriage was in real trouble. Then, over the summer of 1995, they began to argue on a daily basis. And her coworkers noticed a change in Kristen around this time. She went from being the model housewife and efficient nurse to a secretive woman who rarely talked about her husband or children. And if she did talk about Glenn, it wasn't anything nice that she had to say. She was known for calling him stupid.
Yeah, and while all this was going on, there was a change in her appearance. She lost about 30 pounds and dressed, I guess, provocatively would be a way to put it, to show off her new body.
Yeah, sure.
She wore more makeup and changed her hairstyle and color. One day, she even showed up to work wearing a fake nose ring.
It's almost like an early midlife crisis in that way.
Almost. So Glenn began to notice a change when she began bringing a change of clothes to work so she could go out to the clubs after her shift. He'd ask her about it, but then they'd end up fighting, and Kristen would threaten divorce. And then the other strange thing during this time was that Kristen began to prepare home-cooked meals for Glenn on a regular basis. Now, this was new. because they worked opposite shifts and they hardly ever ate their meals together.
And she wasn't a big cook anyway.
No, so what's going on here?
Well, Glenn noticed that the food had kind of a powdery, bitter flavor, but he didn't dare say anything to her about it because he knew it would start another fight. To her friends at work, Kristen began to share her new plans for the future, and she would tell them, "I don't love Glenn anymore. I want to be out of that house by Thanksgiving." Now, it wasn't a coincidence that at the same time, James Perrault, a young security guard at the VAMC, kept coming up in her conversations. She was attracted to this guy.
Certainly was.
Now, Glenn was good-looking in an average way, tall, quiet, and mostly agreeable with Kristen's wishes. And he was a good dad to his kids and a hard worker. But they were having marital problems, and Kristen was throwing around James Perrault's name all the time. And that was upsetting Glenn. I mean, he could see what was going on. He wasn't as stupid as she thought.
So Perrault was 26 years old when Kristen met him. He was a Gulf War veteran who was in excellent physical shape. And becoming a VAMC police officer was a step in the right direction for him because he wanted to be a police officer one day. The VAMC had even sent him to Little Rock, Arkansas for a month-long training course. And because he worked on government property, he was authorized to carry a gun.
In late August of 1995, James began spending more time on Ward C, spending time primarily with Kristen. The two flirted with each other, and oddly, especially during patient codes. James seemed to enjoy all of the attention that Kristen gave him. He was single, and if there wasn't a code, he would go up on his breaks to see Kristen. Most of the nurses didn't think that James was really the smartest guy in the world. But this would just make it easier for Kristen to manipulate him. Kristen started emailing James on the VAMC computer system, and they began planning to take their breaks together, meeting in the library, in the basement, or anywhere where they could be alone. They began meeting after work, too, at the local VFW, and they went out for breakfast at local diners. Kristen asked him to walk her to her car one night when they had been out and they started kissing. And not long after that, they were having sex on a regular basis, usually in his truck or at her house when the kids were at school and her husband was working.
Take the house over the truck.
But she was telling him that she and her husband were going to separate.
Well, what else are you going to say?
That's what you got to say.
So, and the affair progressed, and Kristen was starting to lose the respect of many of her fellow nurses because she was paying less attention to caring for patients and more attention to her boyfriend. She was often late. She usually would disappear during shifts to go see James. James himself was annoying to the other nurses on Ward C.
Well, yeah, because he was always hanging around.
Hanging around. And certainly as the codes became more frequent, he was around more. Because whenever a code was called, a security guy would attend.
Yes.
So that's the reason for him to being at the code.
And many nurses began to notice that the codes and medical emergencies happened only when he was the one on duty. And Kristen and James would openly flirt with each other while they were supposed to be, or she was supposed to be at least, trying to save a patient's life. They were actually seen rubbing their bodies together and touching each other right at the bedside when a guy was dying.
Yeah, I mean, this is all just kind of overwhelming to me.
It's so weird.
You and I have been to some codes on babies and kids. And the last thing on your mind ever is anything other than trying to save that kid's life, that person's life.
Because you care about your patient, though. She didn't.
Obviously not. I mean, I can't comprehend rubbing up against each other while you're performing cardiac compressions or giving meds or something like that.
It's awful.
It's just nuts.
It's disgusting, let's be honest.
When Glenn got home from work on November 5th, he was quite ill with flu-like symptoms. Kristen went to work at 4, and throughout the night, Glenn had muscle cramps and began vomiting, and he felt like he was going to pass out. At around 10:45, he called Kristen at work. So she left work, took Glenn to the ER, and they did some blood tests and stuff. And the ER doctor came in and said that Glenn's potassium level had dropped to a critically low level and that his heart was beating irregularly with cardiac arrhythmias. So potassium is one of those natural substances that everybody has floating around inside them. And it was weird for a man of Glenn's age and physical shape to have a low potassium, because the things that are going to cause that, he didn't have. If you have kidney disorders, diabetes, problems concentrating urine, your urinary tract problems can cause it. He didn't have those. GI problems can cause it. Vomiting, diarrhea, he didn't have those. Medications can cause it. Maybe getting someplace there.
Uh-huh. I see where you're going with that.
Diuretics can cause the problem with low potassium.
Sure.
Steroids.
So, I mean, she was probably giving him something. Let's just get to the point here.
She was probably giving him something to cause his potassium level to drop.
To maybe try and knock him off.
Well, yeah. I mean, she's a smart woman. And one of the side effects of a critically low potassium is, just as the doctor in the ER said, irregular heartbeats with rhythm problems that can lead to cardiac arrest.
And death.
And death. So
after a while, he was released and given a prescription for potassium to get his level back up. And he took the next day off from work. But then after getting most of his strength back the next day, which was November 7th, he did return to work. He was feeling better on November 10th when he went back for an appointment with his doctor to check his potassium level again, and it was back to normal. Kristen had November 11th and 12th off, and on the 11th, an LPN named April saw Kristen walking toward the medical supply closet, which was directly across the hallway from the nurse's station on Ward C. She was surprised to see Kristen there. Kristen was dressed in a sweatshirt and jeans, and she was just kind of pawing through the medicine in the supply closet. When April confronted her, Kristen said that Glenn had not filled his prescription and she was getting some potassium for him. Weird.
Very weird.
Then the next night she showed up again. This time another LPN named Lori watched as Kristen went to the medicine supply closet again. She said again that she needed potassium for Glenn, who had still not filled his prescription. Well, we know that to not be true because his level was back to normal. He'd taken the pills as prescribed.
Exactly.
But what she was taking wasn't even pills.
No, she was giving him potassium chloride in liquid form that you're going to give intravenously.
And you don't do that with anybody. I mean, even in the hospital, you dilute potassium in a big bag of fluids.
Yeah.
You don't just inject anyone with potassium.
No. Well, because when we talked about the effects of low potassium, the effects of high potassium can be even worse. I mean, they will flat out stop the heart.
Well, it's the last thing they give in a lethal injection.
Right.
Now, the VAMC did stock potassium on Ward C in different forms, but the most popular and easily accessible were these tiny clear ampules. If you gave that in large doses, it would be fatal.
Oh, absolutely. The electrical impulses that maintain the heartbeat just quit.
So that's scary.
Very. So after Kristen left, the nurse who saw the incident pulled the nursing assistant into an empty room and told her what she had seen Kristen doing. The nursing assistant actually had her own story to tell. And she said that another day she saw a couple of silver drug packet strips hanging out of Kristen Gilbert's coat. And she saw the VA symbol on the packets and knew that they were from the medicine cabinet. So without removing them from Kristen's jacket, she looked at the names of the drugs, nifedipine and captopril.
So tell us a little bit about these drugs. Why did she have these, you think?
Well, they're both blood pressure medicines. Nifedipine is one that's called a calcium channel blocker. And they're used for blood pressure, maybe certain kinds of heart conditions, and sometimes for stroke victims. But what it does is it causes the blood vessels to open up and dilate. So if you're hypertensive, that lowers your blood pressure. Now, the type of nifedipine that she had in her pocket had never been prescribed for any patient on Ward C.
So there's no reason for her to have that in her pocket.
There isn't. Captopril is another blood pressure medicine. It's called an ACE inhibitor, and that's a acetylcholinesterase enzyme inhibitor, which doesn't matter except that it's, it lowers the blood pressure.
So they both would lower blood pressure.
Right. And I guess if you administered both at once, you could lower the blood pressure pretty dangerously.
Right.
Because they act in different fashions.
Because high blood pressure is bad, but you got to have some blood pressure or the blood's not moving at all and you're dying.
That's right.
That's my simple way of thinking about it.
Well, that's a good enough way to think about it.
Now, during this time period, Kristen did a lot of unexplainable things. She called the veterinarian and asked for some acepromazine for their Labrador retriever, who she claimed was prone to car sickness. And she told the vet that the family was planning a road trip. But neither was true. There was no road trip planned, and that dog had never been car sick. I've owned a lot of dogs. I've never known a dog to get car sick. I'm not saying they can't. I'm sure they can. But I don't think it's very frequent thing that happens.
No, dogs love car rides.
That's been my experience. But Kristen told Glenn that she was drawing his blood at home one day, and she was going to take it to the hospital to recheck the potassium level. So this was after she'd been rummaging through the medicine cabinet and after she'd called the veterinarian. But when she went to draw his blood, she injected a clear liquid into his vein, telling him, who had no medical training at all, had no idea, she told him she had to flush the vein before she drew blood. Now we know that's not true.
Well, not far from it.
That would ruin the whole blood test.
Messes up the test.
Sure. But then when she injected the liquid, Glenn said that he felt numbness in his arm and he passed out for several minutes. He tried to talk to her about it afterwards and she just kind of poo-pooed it. Oh, Glenn, you're making a big deal out of nothing. You just passed out a little bit. And he was passive. He let it go.
Well, yeah, but finally she left him. Kristen left Glenn, and she began to date James Perrow openly.
How lucky was Glenn that she didn't kill him?
It seems like he escaped narrowly.
Yeah, I think so. I think he came close.
But he did. He's still around.
Yeah, so they separated. She's dating James, and Glenn kept the kids while Kristen moved into an apartment. And she saw the kids while Glenn was at work, and she didn't seem to mind that. So well, she seemed okay. I think she was just so excited to have this boyfriend and be able to go out with him.
Yeah, and the stuff we've learned about her, she certainly didn't seem like a maternal type.
No, I think the only time she was maternal is when it served her. So let's take a short break here for our wonderful sponsors.
Okay. What's really great about credit cards is the freedom they give you to do the things in life that you really want and often really need to do. But of course, the downside is the high interest rates.
You pay your bills, and if you have good credit, you shouldn't be paying outrageous interest rates just for the convenience of using your own credit card. Enter LightStream. It's a simple way to save money without piles of forms to fill out and no visits to a bank or lender. This can be done completely online in just one day. LightStream wants to make your life easier, not more complicated.
Now you can get a low, fixed-rate credit card consolidation loan from LightStream and pay off those credit card balances. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and you could get your money as soon as the day you apply. The average credit card company charges over 19% APR, but with LightStream, you can get a fixed rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. Now you can pay off high-interest credit cards and save money with a much lower rate. Apply today at lightstream.com/brewery and get an additional interest rate discount. That's lightstream.com/brewery, LightStream.com/brewery. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/brewery for more information.
Well, you know, I'm always up for saving some money. Like how I save money while I get great hair color at home with Madison Reed Hair Color. You really can take your hair color to the next level at home for less than $25 with Madison Reed. Madison Reed gives you gorgeous, multidimensional, healthy hair with your choice of over 45 multitonal shades that have been developed by master colorists who really know how to blend the nuances of warm, cool, dark, and light. Many of our listeners have written to tell me how Madison Reed Hair Color has improved their lives, and I totally get that. Madison Reed delivers gray covering, natural-looking color to my door. Now I'm free from salon visits, and I'm really saving a lot of money. So I'm always happy to recommend Madison Reed to our listeners. It is affordable, convenient, and it's very high quality. We're busy women, and we deserve gorgeous professional hair color delivered to our doors for less than $25. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. True Crime Brewery listeners also get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using our code BREWERY. That's code BREWERY at madison-reed.com. You'll be gorgeous.
You will. So Kristen's co-workers began to grow suspicious about deaths that always seemed to occur when she was working. Although many of the patients who died were old or in poor health, there were also patients who had no history of heart problems, but were dying of cardiac arrest. And at the same time, supplies of epinephrine, a drug with the potential to cause heart failure, began to go missing.
Yeah, this was pre-Pyxis. I think now this stuff is much better regulated. Although, you know, the code kits that just sit in the hallways probably have that in them. So it still wouldn't be that hard
to
get.
They do, although the code kits that sit in the hallway have the 1 to 10,000 concentration.
So that's a lower concentration.
Way lower.
Yeah.
But yeah, and you were talking about Pyxis, which is like a on-floor pharmacy, and there's a lot more security. You can't just go in and grab a bunch of drugs and nothing.
No, you have to have like access given to you. You have to use a code or a fingerprint. Plus now, I think that cameras are coming up everywhere.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
So, but back in the 90s, it didn't work that way.
No, it was pretty free and loose, actually.
Yep.
In 95, there'd been about 35 codes for the year on Word C alone during Kristen Gilbert's 4 p.m. to midnight shift. Now, remember, we went over all these other deaths and codes back in 90-91. Now it's kind of starting up again, if it ever stopped, actually.
Right.
But even more shocking was that Kristen had found 20 of these 35 codes herself, so more than half. In late 95 and 96, four patients under her care died of cardiac arrest, and in each case, epinephrine was the suspected cause. After three of Kristen's co-workers went to their supervisor with concerns that Kristen may have been involved, an investigation was finally opened.
Yeah, now if you're looking at this kind of dispassionately, you'd say, well, it's about fucking time.
I think that's fair to say. And I think Kristen knew that they were catching up with her because shortly after the investigation started, she left her job at the VA, claiming to have injured herself while at work.
Right. And by that summer of 1996, Kristen and James Perot's relationship had become strained. In September, federal authorities who were investigating the hospital deaths interviewed Perot, and that's when the bomb threats began. On September 26, while working at the VA hospital, Perot took a phone call from someone claiming to have planted three bombs at the hospital. Patients were evacuated and police called, but no explosives were found. Similar threats were made to the hospital the next day and a few days later, all occurring during Perot's shifts. So suspicious stuff there too, huh?
Yeah, so I just want to pause here for a second and go over the four victims that we know for certain were murdered by Kristen. Because well, after all, I mean, this story is about them. They're the ones that suffered from this. Although we know there were many more that she wasn't convicted of for lack of evidence.
Yeah, I've heard upwards of 100.
Yes.
Victims.
I've heard anywhere from 60 to 100, so a lot.
A lot.
But I just want to go over these four.
Yeah, these are the ones that she was convicted of.
Yes, I think these were the ones who were exhumed and examined to
right.
make sure. Yeah, because these were highly suspicious. And the first one is Henry Houdon. Henry was 35 years old in 1995 at the hospital. He died from cardiac arrest, and it was confirmed that this occurred by injection of epinephrine. Henry was a former Air Force assistant physical therapist. He had a mother, Julia Udon, and a sister, Christine Duquette. Henry had become a frequent client on the psychiatric ward at the VAMC. He was an Air Force veteran who had demonstrated excellent performance in all phases of his duties, according to his sergeant. He graduated from East Longmeadow High School in 1977, and he was an above-average student. He actually took the postmaster's daughter to his high school prom, and he took the police chief's daughter to the senior banquet. He was a member of the high school's swim and golf teams. Henry was really an all-American boy, and he followed in his father's footsteps by having a military career. But unfortunately, after arriving at the Royal Air Force Station in Lakenheath, England, Henry and some friends had gone to a local London pizza joint one night, and the base commander, who was there with his wife, children, and another couple, stopped Henry at the door. There were two men fighting in the back of the restaurant, and the commander asked Henry if he would break up the fight. Henry was known as a peacemaker, so of course he walked over to where the men were yelling and pushing each other, and he tried to get in the middle and stop the fight. But while he was trying his best to separate these guys, Henry was struck in the back of the head with a beer bottle, and the impact of his head on the cement floor detached a retina from his right eyeball and shattered his front teeth. Henry was never the same. He was in a coma, and when he finally recovered out of the coma, he had brain damage and was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. So when Kristen killed Henry, he was in the hospital for a gastrointestinal illness and some psychiatric issues. He had no heart condition.
And no history of heart conditions.
No.
And then there was Kenneth Cutting, who was 41 when he died at the VA hospital. And the cause of his death was cardiac arrest by injection of epinephrine. Now, Kenneth was an Army veteran. He had a wife, Nancy Cutting, and a son. He married his high school sweetheart in 1976 and joined the Army a year later. And just a short time after that, he was off to Fort Wood in Missouri for recruit training. On April 11th, months after he left training, Jeffrey Cutting, his son, was born. After boot camp graduation, Kenny was transferred to the 39th Engineers Station at Fort Devens, which worked out perfectly because Fort Devens was located in Ayers, and this was very close to the new ranch-style house he and his wife Nancy had bought. Kenny was living the life he'd always wanted, but a short time after he arrived at Fort Devens, tragedy struck. While in training, only a little over a year into his military career, Kenny called his father to tell him that he had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Now, in the late 70s, many doctors equated MS with a death sentence. And his disease, Kenny's disease, was fairly quickly progressive. So within a couple of years, he had trouble walking and seeing. He vowed to fight the disease, but by 1980, it was obvious to Nancy, his wife, that caring for Kenny at home was going to be difficult. So he first was placed in a long-term program at a Jamaica Plain VA hospital. That's in eastern Massachusetts.
Had a bad reputation, at the time at least.
It did. So he began saying how uncomfortable it was being at that hospital. Then they found that the VAMC in Leeds was a long drive, but did have a reputation for being one of the best VA hospitals in the state.
Except that was the hospital where Kristen worked.
Yeah. So it had short and long-term care units, an acute medical ward, and a staff of doctors that could help make Kenny's life more comfortable. So nurses at the VAMC fell in love with Kenny and his positive attitude, and he soon became a particular favorite of the nurses. Now, because of an infection in January of 1996, he was transferred to the Ward C ICU. Then a few days later, with the infection apparently under control, nurses took him off oxygen, and he began breathing on his own. He was alert and responding well. Now, investigators believe that Kenny's fate was sealed a few days later when Kristen made plans with James Perot for later on that night. Kristen told James that she would meet him at his house around 10 o'clock, and they could go out. Now, this was a kind of an odd time.
Kind of. Doesn't make any sense.
Well, yeah, her shift didn't end till midnight. Kenny's death made it possible for her to leave work early and to meet James. And Kristen had actually asked the charge nurse earlier that day, if Kenny dies by 8, can I leave early for a date?
Now just think about that. That's shocking. That's horrifying.
Yeah, but you know, she does that and nothing happens.
I know, right?
And someone says that to me or you, I need to leave early. You know, maybe he'll be dead by then, and then he is. Holy cow.
I know. So then there was Stanley Jagodowski. He died at the VA hospital at the age of 66 by an injection of epinephrine, which caused him to have a cardiac arrest. He was a Holyoke truck driver and an Army veteran of the Korean War. He did have a reputation for being a real pain in the ass. He'd become a permanent fixture at the hospital, admitted 3 times because the sores on his feet and legs weren't healing. He was 5'7" and 220 pounds, so he was very overweight, and he suffered from diabetes and high blood pressure. Claire, his wife of nearly 40 years, had recently told doctors that she couldn't care for him anymore, and that's why he was there on the long-term unit. He was actually doing quite well, though. When he died suddenly, after Kristen Gilbert was seen going into his room with a syringe.
Then there's Edward Skrira. He died at the VA hospital when he was 66 years old in 1996. His death was also caused by the injection of epinephrine, which caused him, as well, to go into cardiac arrest and die. He was originally admitted to the hospital to treat his alcoholism. Edward was a decorated World War II veteran with a wife and children, and he died just 2 days after Stanley died. And after Edward's death, a fellow nurse began looking for any evidence she could bring to the hospital administration.
So people were getting suspicious, even though nothing was really done yet.
Right, but there's undercurrents of something going on here.
Absolutely.
So this nurse checked the sharps box in the room. The sharps box is where you put syringes and needles and stuff after they've been used.
Mm-hmm.
And she found 3 broken ampules of epinephrine. And these ampules were a strength not used on Ward C.
Yeah, it was the strong strength you were talking about. What is that? 1 in 1,000? 1 in 1,000?
1 in 1,000 dilution. So it's 100 times stronger than
Very
the other
strong.
Stuff.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of dose you'd use for people with asthma that are having an episode. And you give this intramuscularly. The less strong one is the one you can give intravenously for cardiac arrest.
Well, yeah, because anything you give intravenously, they're going to get a lot more concentrated dose.
Right. Quickly.
But the record keeping on the drug was poor. Like we said, it was pretty easy for her to access that.
Yeah, no question. And authorities were cross-referencing the unexpected deaths with Kristen's schedule. And they found, amazingly, a big spike in codes and deaths when she was working. So death seemed to follow her from shift to shift, and it didn't seem that this could happen by pure chance.
It just couldn't, no. Even James Perrault began to believe that Kristen may have been involved in the deaths, as the administration and the investigators were suspecting. He broke up with Kristen, and then she threatened suicide. She was without her husband, now she lost her boyfriend, and her career was over. So she was likely in a panic over the whole situation that she'd put herself in. On September 26th of 96, the VAMC received the phone call saying there were 3 explosive devices in Building 1 of the hospital, and the voice said that the devices would go off in 25 minutes. "I'll see you in hell," the voice said before hanging up. Kristen had already been put under surveillance, so wherever she went, she was followed and watched. The bomb threat shifted the investigators' attention away from the murders and onto the threat. That's what she wanted to happen. The voice was very husky, and it sounded almost computer-generated in the bomb threat. But they had to take the threat seriously, so the whole hospital was evacuated. Sick people had to be moved from their beds and out into the cold. And it turned out to be a bogus bomb threat. The officer who'd been watching Kristen saw her make a call from a payphone at the same time that the bomb threat had been called into the VAMC, and then the call was traced from that payphone to the hospital.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
So after making the call, Kristen had returned home directly. Police obtained a search warrant, and Kristen was home alone. She denied that there was any reason to search her house, told the police that they're investigating the wrong person.
But inside a jacket on Kristen's bed, police found the operating instructions for a device that she used to change her voice. Then looking through a closet, an officer found a Talk Boy. The Talk Boy was a toy back in the 90s that could change the sound of a female voice to the sound of a male voice, or a child's voice to the sound of an adult's voice. So it was pretty popular back when Macaulay Culkin used it. I think it was in Home Alone Part 2.
I didn't bother watching that, so whatever you say.
You didn't miss a lot. But it was a toy that, you know, yeah. You talk into. It makes your voice sound like a grown man or kind of husky.
Yeah.
And I guess she thought that this would work. Not very smart. But it was a huge piece of evidence, at least for the bomb threat.
Oh, it was. And they also found a drug book with the epinephrine page dog-eared. But it wasn't enough to prove that she murdered patients.
No, but it sure does suggest it, doesn't it? Some circumstantial evidence,
right?
Building up. Yeah.
They did, though, have enough to charge Kristen with making the bomb threat. And she went to trial and was convicted and was sentenced to 15 months in a federal penitentiary in Danbury, Connecticut. During her imprisonment, she made a suicide attempt, and she was transferred for a psychiatric evaluation. And that was when she was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. So why don't you tell us what that means?
Well, I know we've talked about this disorder before, and I went back and looked at it, and it's just striking to me how many things in the symptoms of this disorder match up with Kristen. And I just like to say before I go into it that not everyone with this disorder is a horrible person. So one thing is an intense fear of abandonment and going to extreme measures to avoid real or imagined separation or rejection. Now, to me, that's a blinking red light of Kristen. That just describes her very well.
Doesn't it?
Also a pattern of unstable, intense relationships, like idealizing someone one moment and then suddenly believing the person doesn't care enough or is cruel to you. Rapid changes in self-identity and self-image that include shifting goals and values and seeing yourself as bad or as if you don't exist at all. Periods of stress-related paranoia and loss of contact with reality that can last anywhere from a few minutes to a few hours. Also, impulsive and risky behavior, reckless driving, unsafe sex, spending sprees, binge eating, drug abuse, sabotaging your success, suicidal threat or behavior or self-injury, often in response to fear of separation or rejection. Now, we know that each time a guy broke up with her, one of her things to do was to immediately threaten suicide. Wide mood swings lasting from a few hours to a few days, which can include intense happiness, irritability, shame, or anxiety. Also, ongoing feelings of emptiness, inappropriate intense anger, losing your temper, being sarcastic or bitter, or even having physical fights. So what do you think about that? I mean, I think this really describes a lot of her behavior.
Boy, it certainly does, doesn't it?
And if she hadn't gone and killed people, I could feel a lot of sympathy for her. This sounds difficult to live like that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
While she's in prison for this bomb threat, the murder investigation didn't concern her for about 15 months or so.
Well, she couldn't get in the way, at least.
Right. Now, all the victims had been laid to rest, so police didn't have any proof that they had been injected with epinephrine. So they decided to exhume some of the bodies of patients who had died in Kristen Gilbert's care. Now, certainly that's a difficult thing for the families to grasp, isn't it?
It would be really hard, but they did really want to get to the truth, and I guess this was the only way.
Yeah. So they exhumed the bodies, four of them, and autopsy results on the tissue in the bodies showed lethal amounts of epinephrine in these four, and those are the four that were mentioned earlier.
Yes.
So the media attention on the case centered on Kristen's relationship with James Perot, because it was widely believed that she committed her crimes in order to get his attention. Well, but I would submit it's not just his attention, but attention focused on her.
Yeah, attention from anybody who would give it to her, really.
Right.
Because he really did not know anything about this, and he broke up with her when he started hearing about it.
He did. Maybe that's a good thing. He might have been on her hit list.
Well, eventually he probably would have been.
Yeah. So the prosecutor in her case asserted that she was having an affair with VA police officer Perot at the hospital. And Perot testified against Gilbert, saying that she confessed at least one murder to him when she was at the psychiatric hospital for evaluation. She was convicted of murdering four patients. The first one, the jury decided that that was a practice run, so they convicted her of second-degree murder in that one. And the other three, they convicted her of first-degree murder.
Now, why would a practice run make it second-degree?
She wasn't intentionally trying to murder him, is how the jury looked at it. She was trying to figure out doses of epinephrine, and he got too much and he died. But the other murders were first-degree because she intended to kill those people. At least that's how the jury voted.
Okay.
And they also found her guilty of attempted murder in a couple survivors. And one case, they found her not guilty of attempted murder because they couldn't prove anything.
Sure. Well, I mean, she's just a fucking disaster.
No kidding. So Massachusetts had banned the death penalty in 1984, but Kristen could still get that because the murders occurred in a federal building. So federal jurisdiction applied.
So in May of 99, federal prosecutors did announce that they would seek the death penalty. In court, prosecutors said that she murdered because she liked the thrill of the medical emergencies and also that she wanted to impress the new boyfriend. Assistant U.S. Attorney William Welch showed pictures of each of the four men, including one of Stanley Jagodowski in a wheelchair with his two grandchildren on his lap. He also said that each man had a normal heart when he entered the intensive care unit, and Kristen Gilbert tried to cover her tracks by falsifying the medical reports. She liked the emergencies because they attracted attention from other nurses and, of course, from James. On March 26th of 2001, the jury recommended a sentence of life imprisonment. The judge sentenced her to four consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole, plus 20 years. Now, the reason she didn't get the death penalty, it's believed mostly because she had these kids that it would have been really hard on.
Yeah, and the jury was split, not exactly, it was 8-4 in favor of death penalty.
And you have to have unanimous?
And you have to be unanimous. So there were four people, and they decided they were going to vote once. So if it wasn't unanimous on the first vote, they were going to take the death penalty off the table.
Yeah.
And she got life in prison. So Kristen was transferred from a prison for women in Framingham, Massachusetts, to a federal prison in Texas, and she has remained there ever since. She's serving her sentence at the Federal Medical Center, Carswell, in Fort Worth, Texas. So, of course, there's appeals. In July 2003, Gilbert dropped her federal appeal for a new trial after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that would have allowed prosecutors to pursue the death penalty upon her retrial.
Well, so quit while you're ahead.
So, yeah. I mean, if you don't want to be put to death, drop the federal appeal.
Now, we all know that with serial killers, they sometimes say they start out killing animals. And what about her pets? Weren't there an awful lot of deaths of her family pets that were suspicious?
Yeah. I mean, I was reading and learning about this stuff that she didn't have any pets that survived very long.
So what's that all about?
So she was killing them.
Okay. I don't understand why, but I guess I shouldn't understand, I guess. But it is a trait of serial killers, although this is such a different sort of thing than most serial killings. It's really hard for me to piece it together and make any sense in my mind about it.
Well, harming pets, the other thing is arson.
Arson?
That she didn't do, although she did the bomb threats. I guess it's kind of similar.
Yeah, bomb threats are dangerous. I mean, these were sick people that had to be dragged outside, for one thing. Well, if you want to learn more, there is an episode on Oxygen of Snapped Notorious on Kristen Gilbert. There's also a book by M. William Phelps called Perfect Poison. It's really scary stuff. I mean, if you're going to be in the hospital at all, it's kind of terrifying.
It is. We've read a few books by Phelps. He writes a good story. And I think this was his first book, his first true crime book.
Really?
It was Perfect Poison.
I think it was one of the better ones.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
So just a quick reminder that we have lots of TCB merchandise available. If you click on Shop the Brewery on our website, tiegrabber.com, you can click on our TeePublic link to get your summer t-shirts and tanks with your choice of True Crime Brewery designs, colors, and sizes. They also have phone cases, hoodies, mugs, pillows, actually just about anything, you name it. It's worth a look.
Pretty cool. I'm hoping to get more designs on there eventually. I think we have 4 right now. The music for True Crime Brewery was written and produced by Tristan Capel. And just a quick reminder about our membership, Team Tiegrabber. It's a way for you to give support to our podcast and get yourself an extra episode each month. When you join, you get an email with login information, and you get a link that allows you to add our members-only show to your podcast app. Then you have access to all of our past members-only episodes, in addition to a new one each month. Now, in April, we covered and released an Alaska case, and this was the case of Lori Waterman. She was brutally murdered by 2 men who were friends and lovers of her teenage daughter. The daughter, Rochelle, had apparently told these guys that her mom was abusing her, and they claimed that they killed this woman to protect Rochelle. They were really stupid, or I don't know, what's a good word for these guys? Because these guys were in their 20s and Rochelle was a teenager.
Yeah, stupid's a good term.
Okay.
And cruel.
It was a violent death. Anyway, Rochelle really didn't get much punishment either. She's already out and about. So Dick and I had quite a discussion about that, because that is outrageous. Now this month, coming up, and hopefully within the next week, we have a members-only episode on the story of Larentia Bebenek. Did I pronounce that right?
Sure. It's an interesting story.
It's been recommended by several people.
Right. And if you do remember, she had escaped from prison after being convicted of murdering her husband's ex-wife and escaped to Canada. And the theme of her escape was Run, Bambi, Run.
Because that was her nickname,
Bambi. Her nickname was Bambi.
She was kind of a cutie pie, kind of a troublemaker. But for the most part, people believe she was innocent of this murder.
Oh, she was.
You believe it, yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk about that when we get to it.
All right.
Yeah, she didn't kill the woman.
So we'll hear all about that in the next Members Only episode. Also, if you have a couple minutes to spare, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast. So let's move on to feedback now. If anyone wants to share their feedback with us, you can email us at truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com or leave us a voicemail with your comments or suggestions by clicking on Leave a Voicemail on the homepage of our website, tiegrabber.com. Other ways to communicate with us are to join our True Crime Brewery fan discussions group on Facebook or send us a message on Instagram or Twitter.
It's always nice when you leave voicemails to give us your email address so we can respond to you.
Yes, because we can't play them all, but we do like to respond to everyone.
We try to.
Yeah. Okay, Dick, on to feedback.
Okay, I have a case suggestion, a couple of voicemails. Case suggestion from Michelle.
I'm Michelle from Georgia. I guess you can tell from my accent, so y'all don't make fun of me. But I just want to tell you how much I love your podcast. I am a tie grabber, and even though my husband is not that big on true crime, he loves the snifter that you sent us, so thank you very much. And also, don't think I don't catch him listening when I have it on, and he's like asking me questions, and he'll kind of get into it. It's like, oh, okay, you're liking that. Anyway, I'm 53 now, but I pretty much in my high school years grew up on true crime because my mom loved it, and she would read all the true crime books, and one of her favorites was Ann Rule, and so I started reading them. So if she were alive today, she would absolutely love the podcast. So, but anyway, speaking of Ann Rule, I have a case suggestion from one of her books called Never Let Her Go. It's about the disappearance and murder of Anne Marie Fahey. This took place in Wilmington, Delaware. And at the time, she was the scheduling secretary of the governor of Delaware and also had a secret life as the mistress of a millionaire, Thomas Capone, who was convicted of her murder in 1996. This was a great book and could be a great topic for your podcast. Thank you again. And like I said, love your podcast.
Thank you so much, Michelle. That is actually a great suggestion.
Well, we listened to that book by Ann Rule on a recent trip.
That's the one we were listening to?
Yeah, see, you remember it quite well, don't you?
Well, we do listen to a lot of true crime audiobooks. We
listened
when we travel.
To that, and we said we need to do this case, and I think we are sometime this summer, right?
Awesome, yeah. Great.
And Michelle, I lived in South Carolina for 10 years, so I love your accent. I would never say anything bad about it.
No, it's lovely. It just flows nicely.
Yep.
Love a southern accent.
Yeah, I can't talk that way anymore. I got in the habit for a while.
Well, I think if you're there for a while, you kind of catch on to it.
Yeah.
But it's been a long time since you were there.
Long time living there.
Yeah.
Yep. But it was good to hear a southern voice.
Absolutely.
Okay. One more case suggestion from Jan.
Hi, this is Jan from the Chicago area, and I left an email previously, but I know you prefer voicemails. I'm thoroughly hooked on podcasts, and especially your True Crime Brewery, even though I'm not a beer drinker. I've been a true crime fanatic ever since Ann Rule's book about Ted Bundy, and I was always a little embarrassed to admit it to anyone. Now that true crime seems to be what everyone is obsessed with, I don't feel as if I'm the weird one. I wanted to suggest the story of Hillary Norskog, who was murdered by Stephen Fiel, that's P-F-I-E-L, in 1993. She was only 13 and had just recently started hanging out with the group that Fiel was in, and I think he was 17. This happened in the suburbs of southwest Chicago in an area that many would consider a perfect place to raise a family. Actually, my children went to school with the Fiel children. Stephen didn't stick out much as a troublemaker, and most of his teachers and friends had a hard time understanding how he could have murdered Hillary. Although, as it turns out, there must have been some underlying issues that no one was aware of. The story was featured on the show Murderous Minors, Killer Kids, and there was also a lengthy article entitled National Organization of Victims of Juvenile Murderers. The TV show seemed to blame the parents, and they did stand behind Stephen until a few years later. While out on bond, he sexually assaulted his sister, and then he murdered his older brother, who had really been his only friend after the murder of Hillary. At that point, his parents refused to pay any more attorney fees, and I think he pled guilty and received a life sentence without the possibility of parole. I think he was only 19 or 20 at that time. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of gossip about Hillary, her mother, and the Fiel family. So it would be interesting to hear your ideas on the case. And congratulations on your retirement, and keep giving us your excellent insight into the crimes that you feature. Thanks again. Bye.
Thanks, Jan. And I really like the Chicago accent, too. Pretty nice.
It was a good case. It is a good case. The parents of this kid were very much behind him. Until, obviously, he assaulted his sister and killed his brother.
Yeah.
But
it's a deal breaker.
The community that they lived in was so convinced of his guilt that the parents had to move. And they had bought a house a ways from there and tried to fly under the radar. Tough story.
There seems to be a lot to it, though. Might be worth discussing, huh?
It's on my list. We'll see where we go.
And she mentioned the Ted Bundy. And I just have to say, there's this new thing on Netflix called Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, which is another Ted Bundy, movie, which I'm sure there's been plenty of them. But this was really pretty fascinating. Zac Efron played Ted Bundy, but they made him look, not so handsome as Zac Efron is. Because I really don't think Ted Bundy was that handsome. But it's just a fascinating story. And this was kind of from the perspective of his longtime girlfriend, Elizabeth Kendall. When Dick was away golfing on a trip, I sat through this whole thing, plus the Ted Bundy tapes. But I mean, there's just something that fascinates us with that Ted Bundy case for years and years. I don't know if there's ever been another case really like it. And just the footage of how he was in court trying to defend himself It makes good TV, at least. We know that.
It does. Well, and Ted wasn't shy about talking to the camera.
No, not at all. Oh, what an asshole, though, right? He was just a really narcissistic asshole.
There's our narcissism again.
Yeah. But there were some things that the girlfriend had found as clues that I forgot about. And, you know, there were some things that I learned, even though we've done an episode on it and I read the Anne Rule book. It's just, if you're into true crime, I think it is worth watching. Not to glorify a killer. Not for that. But it really does let you know what these women went through. And at the end, I really like the touch of how it listed all the names of his victims, which I think is important. You have to recognize the people who were victimized.
Well, sure. It's not all about Bundy.
No. But wow, what a fascinating thing that was to watch anyway. Okay, what have we got next?
Got a couple emails. I'll do the first one because I saved the other one for you.
Okay, great.
So this is a case suggestion from Melissa, who says, I would like to recommend a case for you to discuss. In July 2003, Larissa Schuster lured her estranged husband to the front door, claiming their son was sick. When Tim Schuster opened the door, Larissa's accomplice, James Fagone, stunned him with a stun gun and drugged him with chloroform. And then Fagone and Larissa Schuster hauled Tim's body into the garage, where they placed him in a 55-gallon barrel and filled it with hydrochloric acid. So his body remained in that barrel for a few days, and when it was discovered, 50% of his body was gone.
Ugh, that's really
morbid. So what a gruesome way to go.
Huh? Yeah.
This crime was covered by Snapped and Dateline, and James Fagone's mother has also written a book discussing her experiences as being the mother of a son who assisted in this horrific crime. It's called Burden of Promise by Relaine Fagone.
Now that I'd be interested in reading, because of course we all sympathize with the mothers of the victims. But you have to think about the mother of a perpetrator. That has to really suck too.
Yeah, doesn't it?
It has to be horrible, because you'd have to be questioning, what did I do wrong to raise someone who would do this?
I know. Now Alyssa goes on to say that Tim Schuster was her mom's second cousin. So this is a crime that hits even closer to home.
Sure.
So we'll look into that, Alyssa.
Yeah, definitely.
And I might be contacting you to help us out with some info.
Yeah, looks like she has some transcripts she's willing to share and help out with the research.
Well, we'll see how much we can find. It's an interesting case.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alyssa. Nice suggestion.
Okay. Last one is a comment from Cheryl.
Cheryl writes, I'm sorry this is kind of lengthy, but I recently listened to both the Jodi Arias and Surviving Ted Bundy episodes, and like some of the people involved, I also belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I thought you might find an LDS perspective on sex useful in understanding the Church's strict standing. We believe sexual intimacy is a powerful gift from God intended for our enjoyment, expression of intimacy, and strengthening the marriage relationship. This gift also contains the profound power to create life, and so it is not to be expressed casually or for mere recreation. Members of the church believe that as we try to live God's commandments, including restricting sex to within marriage, our relationships with spouse and family can continue beyond this life and into eternity. You might compare this perspective to giving your child, whom you love so much, an expensive high-end car. As a parent, you would hope that the child, in addition to appreciating and enjoying the car, could also be trusted to take good care of it, protect it, and not use it recklessly. I'm nearly a decade younger than Rhonda Stapley, but as a church member growing up in the 70s, I also somehow got the impression that it was better to die fighting than to surrender to a rape. I was troubled after listening to her on your podcast, so I decided to find the reason for the church's position. I was pleased to find that, although some individuals may have expressed that opinion, it never was the church's stance and seems to have been more of a cultural misbelief, perhaps a misguided attempt to underscore the great value of our sexuality. Letters from the First Presidency, the highest authority in the church, to general and local leaders gave such counsel as, victims of rape or sexual abuse frequently experience serious trauma and unnecessary feelings of guilt. Church officers should handle such cases with sensitivity and concern, reassuring such victims that they, as victims of the evil acts of others, are not guilty of sin, helping them to overcome feelings of guilt and to regain their self-esteem and their confidence in personal relationships. I discovered it was in fact the legal system in the 70s that perpetuated the victim-blaming mindset, with statutes that demanded a woman must demonstrate resistance in a sexual assault for it to qualify as rape. No wonder many women just didn't report it. Hopefully, as a society, we're improving our attitudes in regard to the victims. So obviously, I'm not going to be trying Dick's beer recommendations anytime soon, but I actually find his reviews really entertaining. Beer that tastes like chocolate cake, specialty brews just for Christmas, dessert beers, you're blowing my mind.
Well, and there's more. More for beers.
Absolutely. But thank you, Cheryl.
I thought that was a good perspective, because we've had some cases that involve people of Latter-day Faith.
Well, and it does bring me back to our interview with Rhonda and how she really did feel like it was better to die fighting than surrender to a rape. My opinion would be that I would fight, not just because of that, but because she would have been killed.
Yeah.
She wouldn't have just been surrendering to a rape. He would have killed her, obviously, because that's what he did. Plus, she had seen his face, so she would have been able to report him. But just imagine, I just can't get over keeping that to yourself and how you could even deal with life. And she went and completed college and all these things. And yeah. I'm just impressed by the strength of that.
But she's right about the victim blaming, which still occurs.
Still occurs. I think it occurs less. But you're right, it does still occur. And that's something that we really need to work on as a society, no matter what our beliefs as far as religion goes, right?
I agree.
But I really appreciate the education given to us by Cheryl, as I appreciate all of our listeners who write in and call in and share their various opinions from all over the world. It's just fascinating and really a gift to us. We're just sitting here talking and people share that with us. It's great. So the feedback is the best thing we ever did with this podcast, Dick.
We've said before, we have wonderful listeners.
We do. And even the ones who don't agree with us.
There's always something to learn.
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to just thank everyone again for listening and for writing in. And we will see you next week at the Quiet End.
We will. Save a seat.
Bye-bye.
Bye.